A very warm welcome back to the Tottenham Way. We've all been away during the international break, but luckily, nothing happened at Spurs during that time. Well, apart from the usual carnage, we said goodbye to Antonio Conte. We've seen Fabio Paratici pick up a worldwide ban less than 24 hours after his rallying cry on behalf of the club ahead of the run-in. We've seen 4 points squandered in successive away games at Southampton and Everton, while Newcastle have, of course, strengthened their claims for a top four spot. King Harry has been accused of gamesmanship. And with Leicester and Chelsea sacking their managers, the waters have been muddied even more in terms of who is going to take over and where. It's an alarming scenario ahead of Brighton's visit this weekend, and what a significant game that could prove to be. I'm Marcus Buckland, Dan Kilpatrick of the Evening Standard, Tom Barkley of the Sun, and Tom Allnut of the Times are reunited and have much to ponder after a miserable end to March and a pretty atrocious start to April. Dan, let's start with Monday night. I'm sure Antonio Conte was watching. What do you think he'll have made of that first Spurs performance since his official departure?
Hi, Marcus. Yeah, I'm sure he was watching. I imagine it would have been hard to stay away from that, even given his feelings about the club. I think he would probably have felt vindicated, justified in his rant at Southampton. I think, obviously, much has been made of that, and the message from Conte was not these aren't good players, or even you know, these players can't follow my tactical instructions. It was these players aren't together. These players have a weak mentality, have questionable characters, and the Everton result was not really about tactics, I didn't think, or their ability as players. It was just about the way they managed the game in the last 20 minutes. Completely ceded the initiative, the impetus to Everton, despite being a goal up and having an extra man. So I think Conte, watching from his living room in Italy, would probably have felt, well, I've been proved right here, because this is another example, just as the Southampton game was, of you know, seemingly Spurs being unable to handle you know, a relatively straightforward situation, kind of crumbling under the pressure. That was another one of his messages at Saints, wasn't it, that they didn't like playing under the pressure, the players. And here was Spurs, you know, with a golden opportunity to go third, to leapfrog Newcastle and United against a side they're obviously better than, a side battling relegation, and you know, they completely blew it from a position of strength and a position that I think every other, you know, Big Six or Big Seven side would have, you know, comfortably seen out the win, if not scored again. Most teams in the Premier League would probably have found a way to win from there, but Spurs couldn't. So, you know, sadly, as much as I think, and we've all said, that, you know, Conte was self-serving in a way in what he said, and you know, there were other factors in Spurs' difficult season, I think he would feel, well, I've been vindicated there.
Tomby, there are so many questions on the back of that game, the last 20 minutes in particular, because actually I thought for the first few minutes when Spurs had the extra man, they were all over Everton. They got the goal, and then this extraordinary retreat and an extraordinary substitution, it has to be said, from Stellini to bring on Lucas Moura. I mean, just why? Can you explain what happened in the closing stages of that game?
Well, it's interesting hearing Dan's point about Conte being vindicated with what he said. And there is definitely some truth in that. And that was my match report takeaway, was maybe Antonio had a point. But I do feel like you can't alleviate the blame from the manager as well. And that's almost still on him, because it's so ingrained in the way this team play. And Stellini seems to have just continued with that, very, you know, literally the same setup. I couldn't see any discernible difference from the Conte style to the Stellini style. And I do think the way that they invite pressure on, you know, throughout matches, not just in that final sort of half an hour, does mean that this is more likely to happen to Tottenham than it is to any other team. So I'm not going to give the manager a complete pass on that and just blame it all on the players and the fact that they couldn't handle the pressure, albeit that is a fair point. When it comes to Moura, I can only deduce that Stellini feels exactly the same way as Conte did about Arno Danjuma, in that Conte was asked about him a few weeks ago when he was still the manager, why he wasn't playing Danjuma. And he said that he felt sorry for him, that he was essentially a club signing and that he didn't see him fitting into his team. He saw him as more of an orthodox winger than one of the number 10s, as he put it, the Son and Kulusevski positions or Richarlison positions. And he thought once he went that maybe this would be a chance for Danjuma, but again, he was completely left out. And it is baffling that Moura, who's everyone's expecting to leave in the summer, still got given a chance. And obviously it's sad for the way potentially his career may have ended, because you wonder if he's got a 3-game ban now, how many more games he will play for Tottenham. At least maybe that might give Danjuma a chance, although you wouldn't bet on it just because of the way Stellini seems to think in the same way that Conte did about him.
To be clear, I don't think Conte was vindicated. I think he would have felt vindicated.
Yeah, okay, no, that's a fair point.
Yeah, I don't think he was proved right, but I think watching from home, he would have felt, my point's been proved by the players here. And the shame is that, you know, that was a great opportunity, or the first opportunity, should we say, for the players to really go out and prove him wrong. You know, that was, as has been written, I think by Jack Pitbrook in The Athletic, that was the player's right of reply to Conte for the, you know, for his rant and for his comments. And, you know, they've got more to come, obviously, but they fluffed that one.
Conte, we are led to believe that we have Stellini now for the rest of the season. First of all, why did the club make that decision? And secondly, might they have to change their mind because of the recent activities at Leicester and Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, the Stellini appointment, I think, was a bit left field. I think most people expected, if it was going to be a kind of an interim internal candidate, most people were expecting that to be Ryan Mason. And I guess, you know, when you think about it, Stellini having been in charge for those games when Conte was away, I guess, and he did reasonably well. You know, I think we've said on this pod before that we've all been fairly impressed with him as a person and the way he conducts himself in the press. So I guess, you know, the big thing that we've already seen with Stellini, and that was going to be very clear, I think, from the outset, is that this represents in no way at all a fresh start or a break from Conte. This is very much Conte light. You know, I mean, in everything that Stellini says, the way he talks about football, the way he talks about the game, his tactics. I mean, you know, he just very clearly has a very personal affiliation with Conte as well. You know, he said in his first press conference the other day, as since his appointment, that, you know, he owes his career essentially to Conte, and that he even kind of said, which struck me, you know, that I want to kind of do well for Antonio, you know, as though this is almost kind of payback to him. You know, in no way is Stellini seeing this next couple of months as a chance to kind of showcase his own ideas, his own style, his own tactics. This is Conte continuation in every single way, apart from the fact that Conte is there. Now, that may or may not be a successful formula, but from the player's point of view, I can imagine that the one thing Conte had was his kind of Conte-ness. You know, the one thing that you have with Conte is that he has a winning CV, he has charisma, he has a certain kudos that even if you find him objectionable and irritating and negative, you know, you still think this guy's worth believing in. If you take away the Conte-ness and all you have is the sort of Conte tactics and the negativity, well, you know, in a way, you've lost the one thing that was kind of dragging the club along for this season. And, you know, I mean, that sounds harsh on Stellini. I mean, I did a slightly off-the-wall kind of interview with the Alessandria president, who, you know, sacked him basically from his only other job in management last week. And he was saying, you know, that he's a fantastic guy, that, you know, he still keeps in touch with him, that he was really impressive as a coach, very demanding, very high on the kind of physical side of the game. And all of this sounds very much like Conte. You know, this is what we know Conte is as well. And I think the one thing that Spurs might have had an opportunity to do in sacking Conte was to kind of have someone else to come and breathe life into the squad, you know, to allow the team to attack, to play in a slightly different way, to maybe loosen the strings a little bit, you know, all those kind of old cliches. But I don't think they're going to get that positivity from it. And I guess it's just a case now of whether or not the continuity is enough to kind of keep them in the top four. But in my view, always this was going to come at a price. And, you know, you mentioned the Leicester and Chelsea situations. And a couple of weeks ago, the shortlist that Tottenham had, in my opinion, looked brilliant. You know, you look at those kind of four or five candidates that we were discussing two or three weeks ago, and it was a luxury situation. You know, do you fancy having Pochettino, you know, probably one of the best managers Tottenham have ever had, back? Or do you fancy having Luis Enrique, who's won the treble with Barcelona? Like, you know, these are you know, fantasy options for Tottenham. And yet here we are 2 weeks later because the club want to buy themselves time. And that comes at a very heavy price because, you know, as it happens in football, the game moves on, and now you have another very big fish, very much hunting in the same waters, you know, and that's only gonna happen more. By the way, you know, in the next few weeks, there are going to be other big teams looking for other managers, and all these managers that Spurs are looking for are going to be on the shortlist of other big clubs. And we're seeing now that Chelsea are moving more decisively, more aggressively. And I think Tottenham may come to rue their decision to basically buy themselves time. It was a cautious decision, in my opinion. And I can understand why they did it, but I think it's going to cost them at least one or two candidates come the summer.
Just to play devil's advocate, how much can you blame that on Spurs? Because some of the feedback I've got over some of the candidates is that they wanted to wait until the summer themselves to see what other options were out there. So say it's a Pochettino, for example, then if they're maybe in the running for a Real Madrid, what can, I'm not saying specifically him, but quite a few of these candidates, you know, there are other realistically bigger jobs that may be available. And whilst they might be interested in Tottenham, they're sort of waiting to assess their options. And either you just go for someone that you know you can get now, or you try and hold on for a bit longer for someone you think might be a bit better, but you're going to have to sort of bide your time and hope they say yes in the summer. I'm not saying that this sort of completely sort of vindicates any approach they've gone, but I do wonder if that is coming into it, that the fact that it's not through choice that they're having to wait.
We're already seeing Chelsea, as Tom says, just act more decisively. It looks like they're going after Nagelsmann. I think Enrique's flying over for talks. You know, Spurs are still in the scoping things out, due diligence kind of stage. And I think this sense that managers want to wait to the summer is only true till they get an offer they can't refuse, right? And then suddenly, you know, Nagelsmann, having probably said that to Spurs, might pitch up at Chelsea. But just to go back to Stellini, I think, you know, one interesting thing is his own future, really. You know, he's only 47. He's going to be working in the game for a long time afterwards. He presumably sees this possibly as an opportunity to impress enough to get another managerial job. But also, you imagine he might be thinking about rejoining Conte in his next job, you know, at a top job in Italy next season. So, you know, for Stellini, he really can't kind of distance himself too much from Conte if he wants to work with him again. You know, he really can't come out say anything critical of the former regime, and maybe even he'll feel like he can't particularly deviate from Conte's approach either. So I think you're in the situation where there's just no sense that the players can get a fresh start. I think we were all kind of hoping that there might be something quite different on Monday night. And as soon as the teams came out, it was just obvious that was the exact team Conte would have picked. And as we've said, you know, right down to the substitutions, they were the substitutions Conte would have made. You know, it was almost as if we were back, you know, in February and Conte was ill at home and Stellini was on the touchline, but Conte was the one kind of pulling the strings from his living room. You know, that's what that game felt like. It might as well have been that.
I wonder, taking on the points we've already made, that that game on Monday was perhaps a right of reply for the players. And Stellini said, OK, I'll give you that right. It will be interesting, bearing in mind how that game turned out, to see what 11 he picks on Saturday and whether he now feels, well, look, I did exactly what Conte would have done, and I want to show respect to my predecessor. But now I have got an opportunity to perhaps tinker a little bit. And obviously, we'll only find that out on Saturday. But just in terms of the way the club is being run at the moment, I know it's so easy, of course, to criticise those at the top. And goodness me, they do deserve a fair amount of criticism. But do they really know what is going on? I mean, the Stellini thing, okay, it's a bridging gap. But what about the business with Paratici? He was put forward as the front guy following Conte's dismissal. He gave the big rallying cry, what we're going to do over the final 10 games of the season. And less than 24 hours later, he picked up a worldwide ban, which by all accounts came as a complete surprise to the club as well. Why does nobody at Tottenham know what's going on?
Yeah, the Paratici situation is astonishing, really. Not least because Spurs' defence was basically, we didn't know. It was essentially the Boris Johnson defence, wasn't it? It was, we just weren't sure what was going on, and we didn't do anything intentionally or deliberately. We've just kind of ended up in this situation. But everyone knew, right down to kind of the most scantily informed supporter, that this could happen. You know, it was widely known that Paratici's ban could be extended from just Italian football to the whole world. The timing was admittedly a bit of a surprise, I think, because the expectation was that the Italian FA would not make that request to FIFA until after the appeal, which is now on April 19th, we know. But still, you know, you'd think Spurs would have been on top of this, you know, in communication with FIFA, you know, somewhat more alive to the possibility and aware of what was going on. But I think that even that misses the point, really. You know, the point is that Paratici really should never have been kept on by Spurs once he was banned from Italian football. I mean, all the other directors involved, Juventus, promptly resigned. You know, Spurs have just carried on, you know, seemingly hoping this situation will just go away. Obviously, it hasn't. And it's come at the most inopportune time for them, you know, at a time where they're looking for a new head coach. He's supposed to be leading that process. You know, we're told he's the one who's drawn up the initial shortlist. He's the one who was conducting due diligence. And now suddenly, you know, he's unable to work for the club. And after April 19th, who knows what's going to happen? So when the club should be, you know, moving fast to get ahead of Chelsea, get ahead of Real Madrid, PSG, other clubs who were looking for a manager, they're once again in a situation where they're essentially paralysed and unable to act. And the parallels to summer 2021, I think, are getting more and more and kind of increasingly concerning.
Well, Richard Crackers Cracknell is a very well-known Spurs fan who appears on a lot of podcasts. And I saw a tweet from him the other day, which totally struck a chord with me. And he said that if Daniel Levy was Daniel Levy's boss, Daniel Levy would sack Daniel Levy. Now, ultimately, he has to carry the responsibility for what's happened with Paratici. He surely has to carry the responsibility for all the managerial appointments and the fact that it's 15 years since Spurs won a trophy. I know that Tottenham balanced their books, and that's important for Enoch, and Daniel Levy is clearly an incredibly sharp, brilliant businessman. But football is different from business. Have we not seen just too many times now examples of having the wrong guy in charge? He's doing what the owners might want, but for goodness sake, this can't carry on. If you want to be a brilliant businessman, Daniel, go into the business world. You'll be a superstar. But this is football. When, guys, if ever, is it going to change?
I mean, I personally think, I mean, you know, almost ironically, you know, the whole point of Paratici was to kind of reduce Levy's fingerprints on the kind of football side of the club. He came into the club because it almost in the kind of, I think I've got my timeline right here, you know, post sort of Super League. And the idea was that he would come in and kind of take the pressure a little bit off Levy, you know, and that he would be involved in the kind of transfers in all football operations. That Levy would step back a little bit. So that I do in this sense of, I understand the kind of idea of chaos and things, but I do think some of the reaction to all this has been slightly overblown. I do personally think that, yes, you know, Spurs are not in a good place right now. No one can argue that. But it is the case all over Europe that big clubs go through these periods when coaches leave, executives get fired. You know, there are cases where they have to deal with legal situations. This it's not, you know, completely unprecedented. I think in the kind of Tottenham bubble, this feels like an existential crisis. But equally, if you kind of zoom out, they are on track to finish in the top four, whether they do or not, let's see. They are probably going to get in a very good manager in the next few weeks or in the summer. They have a very good squad still. It's maybe not as good as it was 2 or 3 years ago. They have the top scorer in their history still on the books of the club. They have, as we all know, best stadium, best training ground, yada, yada, yada. In my opinion, this is a club right now that is going through undoubtedly some turbulence. But I don't think it's the kind of situation where you say everything that has gone on for the last 20 years has been a complete nonsense. There is a reason, you know, not to kind of go back into this whole trophy thing, but the main reason why Tottenham don't win trophies is because there are 10, 15 other clubs in Europe who basically are bigger, have more money, and are better equipped to win those competitions. There's no God-given right why Tottenham should be winning the Champions League every year. There isn't. There's 5 or 6 teams who are much better equipped to do that. And in the Premier League, okay, that pool is smaller. And yes, the Arsenal situation brings into, you know, sharp focus the fact that it can be done. But ultimately, most seasons, there are 2 or 3 clubs, at least 4 or 5 clubs, if you look at the spending on wages and transfers, that are better equipped than Tottenham to win trophies. That doesn't explain why they haven't won 1 or 2 in the last kind of couple of decades. But if we're talking about Daniel Levy and the ownership and everything, I think sometimes people need to kind of zoom out and say, actually, the broader picture here is that probably come next season, everything will be calmer again. And I can understand why they kind of kept it. I understand Dan's point about they should have acted on Paratici earlier. But the essential point is they believe in Paratici. They believe that he's an extremely good, slick operator who actually in his time at Spurs has done some pretty good things. And they probably have hung on to him too long, but they essentially wanted to hang on to him because they rate him. Like, it's definitely not been a good few weeks for Tottenham. No one is saying that. And as a journalist, you know, it's been a constant news cycle. But equally, it's a crisis that can be quite quickly sorted out. If they start making good decisions, it's a crisis that can be come through, in my opinion.
I agree with that. You know, Spurs are only a couple of decent appointments, you know, let's say a manager and possibly a replacement for a Paratici, you know, 2 solid progressive appointments away from being in a much, much better place. You know, you look at United and people were saying they were kind of ungovernable while the Glazers were still in charge. And then suddenly they appoint, you know, a progressive manager who plays good football, win a trophy in their first season and look like, you know, they're back for the long term. But I still think that's quite a generous interpretation. I mean, the bigger picture is obviously okay, but the last 4 years really since Pochettino's been sacked have just been chucked away. I think the one redeeming feature for Spurs is that they've still got this strange ability to keep themselves in the kind of top 4, top 6 picture that we have talked about in this pod before. I think a lot of that is down to Kane. You know, you suddenly take Kane's goals away from the team, you know, and it could be pretty diabolical. So take your point, but I think, you know, it's been such a mess. And the problem is, I think no one really has much confidence left. Or I certainly don't have much confidence left that the board are going to, you know, get these decisions right, because nothing since failing to back Pochettino and since sacking him have suggested that they are, you know, about to make an inspired choice. There's no evidence to suggest that.
I take your point, Tom, but I think it's the point that Dan's made of the last 4 years is really the key point, because that was the period when you had arguably the best striker in the world at your club for a good few years. And it's the question of whether they've squandered that opportunity by not building properly. I know that I've been a defender of the money they've spent in the last season. I think Conte was backed, but the choices of manager, you can understand why they went for them. Maybe not so much Nuno, but you can understand why they went for Mourinho, why they went for Conte. In hindsight, they looked like poor appointments, but at the time, you could see why they went for a Mourinho after a Pochettino, going for a different route. But and the same with Conte. But ultimately, they've been proved to be flawed appointments. And specifically, but I'm willing to sort of look at that and say on the one hand this, on the other hand that. With Paratici, I guess it depends on how much they knew before they appointed him that there could be something coming down the line on that. I'm not sure exactly on that, but if that is the case, then there's question marks over that. But also, just some of it is so self-inflicted because there's nothing really to do with Tottenham, and they've had their opportunities to move him on when he, as Dan said, when he first got banned, and since. So I just don't really know why they're just continuing to have this damage they're laying on themselves when it really isn't necessary.
Interesting, Tommy, trying to give a balanced opinion of what Spurs have done. And Gary Neville's been tweeting, you know, telling all Tottenham fans to show perspective, the fact that we are somehow still in the top four. And I think immediately most Spurs fans would turn around to Gary Neville. Well, they might turn around and do a few things to him, but they would say, it doesn't matter where we are. It's the way we've been playing for such a long time. And it just is not part of the club. And it may be a cliche, but Tottenham have always played flowing football, well, up until the last 3 or 4 years anyway. And that can put a lot of other things to one side. You're actually enjoying what you are watching. On the subject of Harry Kane, we're going to have to just touch upon the incident the other night. And Dan, I've read your excellent article in The Standard defending the England captain. He has been absolutely slaughtered, I think is a fair word for his reaction. The close-up picture actually in The Standard as well does seem to show that Doucouré's got a finger actually in his eye. So we all saw what happened. He is the England captain. This is football where people will milk situations. Let's be absolutely honest. It's a Tottenham podcast and we all love Harry Kane. But just quickly, I'm interested in getting all three of you to just surmise your thoughts on what he did and the general reaction to what he did as well.
Yeah, I did my column on this in the paper today because I just thought the reaction was so strange. I mean, obviously, Kane went down theatrically. There's no question about that. But more or less every other player in the Premier League would have reacted that way. I mean, like it or not, that is just the way Premier League players are conditioned. You go down if someone strikes you above the neck. You want to give the referee no choice but to make the decision that's going to be advantageous for your team. It looked like he'd been slapped in the face, which I think would have been kind of painful enough. But actually, as you mentioned, Marcus, the kind of close-up replay makes it look like an eye gouge and a claw. And there's been next to no kind of criticism of Doucouré, who nearly and really should have cost Everton the game in a very precarious situation at the bottom of the table with a stupid, stupid moment of losing control. But instead, all the focus has been on Kane. I just think he's held to completely different standards to most other players. Maybe you could say as England captain that's kind of fair because he's such a great professional in other ways. But I just think it was, you know, to call him a disgrace and embarrassing and say he's milking it and, you know, all the kind of reaction on social media and in, you know, some elements of the actual broadcast and print media as well. I think it just more speaks to the fact that Kane's just kind of disliked by a lot of people, which I find curious given what he's done for England and the kind of character he is.
I find it completely bizarre how he, as you say, is judged to different standards, and there just often seems to be this dislike of him. I just can't get my head around it. As someone who doesn't support Tottenham, but has always admired him in particular, and before covering them, he's just a fantastic player. And I don't really understand why more people don't just enjoy all the qualities he has. But every time it seems to be anything, I say controversial. I don't even know why this is controversial, but apparently in some people's eyes it is. A lot of people seem to come down on the side of being against him. Maybe it's just a classic case of people, you know, enjoying knocking down people, successful people, I guess, and particularly one of England's own. I don't know why we do that generally as a society. We just often seem to do that. But he is weirdly often the target of this kind of thing. And I mean, Sean Dyche after the game was asked about it, and he didn't. I don't think he had any criticism, at least in the TV interview, of Kane's reaction. The only thing that he sort of suggested was he didn't think that Kane's challenge, I believe, on which Everton player was it before Doucouré came in? I've forgotten now.
But right, I think
Gray, was it? Was it Gray? Yeah, that was, he said that was unnecessary, and maybe he had a point there, but he wasn't having a go at Kane's reaction. And as Dan says, don't know why people weren't having more go at Decore, because he's lost his head, and he really should have cost Everton 3 points. So I just find that this weird thing that seems to keep on happening, and presumably will continue to happen until he probably retires, and people sort of then look back on what a great player he was, after they can no longer watch him.
I think it's about standards, but I also think it's about expectations. Like, people don't like being surprised in football, and everyone expects Kane to deliver a certain kind of, I don't know, we all know what Kane is. You know, you think about the words you think about with Kane, it's always, hard work, professional, mentality, role model, all these kind of things. And by the way, he's complicit in that kind of branding, if you like. You know, that is very much the Kane brand. So whenever we see him do something that slightly steps out of that very narrow circle, people sort of get very irate about it. I mean, am I right in saying he's never been sent off in his career? And the day, by the way, he gets sent off, which may or may not happen, even if it's an innocuous second yellow card, that would be a big story, because it's Harry Kane getting sent off. That is not the same as Jack Grealish getting sent off, or they just don't have the same kind of persona, So I agree, he is held to higher standards, but I think it's also because everyone is so sure now that they kind of know Harry Kane really, really well, that when he steps outside that and does something that's slightly out of character, everyone thinks that that's a huge story.
Yeah, the one thing I loved about all of that was a few moments later when the penalty was given, and he had to put up with plenty of gamesmanship from Jordan Pickford in particular. And disloyally, I actually said to somebody I was watching the game, oh no, I've got a horrible feeling that Kane might miss this. I should have known better. It was the perfect penalty and the perfect response. And if only we had 11 Harry Kanes. And well, we won't go into what might happen if he leaves in the summer again, but it is unbearable. What is coming next, though, is the visit of Brighton on Saturday. Perhaps when Roberto De Zerbi sits down, we'll have to padlock him to the dugout and say, no, you're staying here until the start of next season, because he's done an astonishing job. They've won again during the week at Bournemouth to further enhance their chances of perhaps even finishing in the top four. We know how well they're playing. We know how they play. We all remember how they beat Tottenham at Tottenham last season. This guy's has the potential, has it not, to turn into a very toxic Saturday afternoon in North London.
Yeah, it absolutely could. And Brighton are definitely the kind of team who, if Stellini continues to play in the sort of Conte mode as we expect, could really expose that and cause them problems very, very quickly. They're full of really talented players who are so good at manipulating the ball and will be looking to make a fast start against a team that's obviously low on confidence, and where the atmosphere around the stadium could be something they could really capitalise on. I think Brighton are pretty good at going away from home as well. I think on a bit of a run away from home, and De Zerbi, who we talked at length before, but one of the things I really like about him is how he doesn't downplay things. If anything, he embraces the hyperbole, maybe, or the sort of daring to dream aspect of Brighton's aspirations to get into Europe this season, and he will really get his team ready to make the most of it. And I was just thinking about these two sides, and this is the chance where a lot of people, as you've just pointed out, might be hoping that he'll be swapping the away dugout for the home dugout in the summer. But from a team point of view, and you never would have said this at the start of the season, but based on the performances of the players this season, really sure beyond Harry Kane and Evan Ferguson looks a real prospect, by the way, but obviously it's Harry Kane, he would have to be in the team. How many Tottenham players would actually get in a combined 11? I'm not sure beyond Kane there are any that are definitely have to be in there. Maybe Romero, you could argue Porro, the goalkeeper at Brighton, Jason Steele has literally just come into the team, so maybe there, but then we all know about Tottenham's goalkeeper issues. And I guess maybe Bentancur, but they've got a World Cup winner in midfield and a 70, 80, 90, 100 million pound rated midfielder alongside him. And I really like Pascal Gross as well. So, this is a Brighton's team. I don't know if that speaks more to Spurs' deficiencies this season or just how Brighton have come from really nowhere, building just so brilliantly to being a team that I mean, if anything happened at the weekend, you wouldn't be surprised because they're such a talented outfit.
I have to say, I just think that's the effect of good coaching, to be honest. Like, I don't think Brighton have a better squad than Spurs. I don't even think it's that close, really. I just think, if Spurs had a top progressive coach, then suddenly we might be saying, oh, you know, Clement Longley's played in the Euros and is a former France international. We've got Eric Dier in England international. And suddenly you start seeing the positives in all the players because the coach is bringing out the best in them and making them all look like top players. And that's not to say Brighton don't have good players. You know, I largely agree with your assessment, but I think Spurs have a stronger squad. I just think Brighton are being coached superbly by De Zerbi, and, you know, he's making them greater than the sum of their parts. And Spurs, although they're still fourth in the table, just have looked much lesser than the sum of their parts throughout the season, really, and particularly in terms of performances, if not results, because that they just seemingly, have had a manager in Conte who, for whatever reason, hasn't been able to get the best out of individuals or the team. I think just generally that it's a kind of fascinating game. It's the sort of best run club in the Premier League against, you know, one of the worst. It's a team that's going to want to dominate the ball and play, really cutting edge, kind of great press resistant football against a side who, you know, haven't really wanted to have the ball for most of the season. Then there's the kind of De Zerbi angle. I think we've discussed it on this pod before, but, you know, I think he should be really high on Spurs' list. But there's still this question about, you know, plucking him from that incredible structure at Brighton, as we saw with Potter. It's all so well set up for coaches there, you know, plucking him from that and just kind of sticking him in the sort of chaos of Spurs, you know, would it work? I'm sure, as I think Tom Allnutt said a couple of pods ago, that, you know, Spurs would want a bit of a bigger sampler size before taking a risk on him. But I think he's just done such a good job. And, you know, as we sit here now, that the Saturday's game will have a big bearing on it. But I wouldn't bet against Spurs finishing above Brighton as it stands, because they just look like a side with momentum, belief, you know, confidence. And as I said, just much greater than the sum of their parts, which, you know, none of which you can really say about Spurs at the moment.
Tom, just to revisit a point I made a bit earlier, we spoke about how Stellini was very true to Conte on Monday night, and I suggested, well, maybe he had to do that. He had to give those players a right of reply after the outburst following the Southampton game. But do you think, particularly bearing in mind the opposition at the weekend, that Stellini might be brave enough to make a couple of little tweaks to loosen the handbrake a little bit? Let's remember how Brighton completely outplayed Spurs at home last season. Here's Stellini's chance now to show that he's his own man. Are we going to see that?
I doubt it, to be honest. I doubt it. I would be surprised. It would go against everything that we've heard and seen so far from Stellini. I suspect he'll stick with the plan. He said in his first press conference that they had already, with Conte, been working on some kind of tactical tweaks that they could now follow through on. But let's see what they are, you know. I mean, I think it's a good point that Dan makes, that, you know, when you compare De Zerbi and Conte this season, and I generally consider myself to be broadly a sort of more sympathetic on the spectrum towards Conte and what happened over his 2 years. But I do think if you look at it and you compare the teams, you know, one of Conte's parts of his legacy that will probably get forgotten in 2 or 3 years' time, when all we remember is the rant and the kind of explosiveness and everything, is actually, you know, which players at Tottenham did he make better? You know, which players in that team improved under his stewardship? You know, and you compare that to De Zerbi at Brighton, but more from a Tottenham point of view, for example, Pochettino's time. You know, Pochettino had players like Rose and Walker and players, Dele Alli, of course, you know, who ultimately became stars under his tenure, under his coaching. They weren't already ready-made stars. And that's the big problem that I have with Conte, is that he complains a lot about the players that he has and about the mentality, but ultimately that is his job. Like, that is the culture is set by him. You know, there's been a lot of talk in the last few days about the culture at Tottenham coming from the owner, and and from the board, and fine, maybe to some extent, but ultimately the culture is set by the manager, you know, and he set that culture where basically players were allowed or at least, you know, didn't feel comfortable enough to be playing above their par. Everyone was playing 2 or 3 points below their par, and that is when a team is misfunctioning. I think De Zerbi, you know, is a really compelling coach. I suspect that, you know, I spoke to a couple of people in Italy recently, and he said he's really highly rated there, and that any jobs that come up in the summer over there, those clubs will be right in there for him. But I would imagine that he'll be quite keen to stay at Brighton. He's in the Premier League. He's got a great, talented team. I would think if he's sensible, he'll stay there for another year and try and build on what he's done. I mean, whether or not Brighton have enough to get in the top four, most people seem to keep on writing them off and think they're not in the mix. But ultimately, I suspect the team that loses this weekend will find it very difficult to get in the top four, because ultimately Tottenham have played 2 games more. You know, if you think that Newcastle and Manchester United might take at least 4 points from their 2 games in hand, well, Tottenham are already 3 or 4 points behind them. If they lose again, that could be 6 or 7 points. So that's a big gap, you know, and at some point that reality is going to dawn on Spurs. And equally for Brighton, you know, they are a few points behind. I think if they lose, then they're going to struggle as well to kind of keep pace. So I think it's a really big game. If it goes badly wrong for Tottenham, then I agree that the atmosphere could quickly turn, and it might even be the kind of result that prompts a kind of a change of thinking with regards to the managerial search. Let's see.
Yeah, it's not almost a must win for Spurs, but as you pointed out there, it's not far off, is it, because of the way the situation is and how many games they've played. And just back to your point about Conte not making players better. I mean, Yves Bissouma, he's the sort of forgotten man, obviously being injured, but he was kind of the forgotten man before then. He's almost like an embodiment of that. I mean, he's a player who earned his move to Tottenham through mainly Graham Potter, was it? Well, obviously all Graham Potter, because it was before De Zerbi came in. The way he made him into a player who could dominate matches, particularly, remember a couple of games at Stamford Bridge where he was the best player on the pitch, to a point where he got a move to a side like Tottenham. And I mean, I don't know if he had any good games before he got injured for pretty much the rest of the season under Conte. So that he for me would be sort of the prime example of that lack of improving players that that I think the next coach really needs to be strong at.
Well, certainly watching Roberto De Zerbi on the touchline at the weekend is going to be fascinating. A huge game. And I'm up for it. Isn't it funny as a football fan? You say, that's it, every week. I've said it 4 or 5 times in the past month. I said it again on Monday night. And now I'm looking at my watch and saying, not long till 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. That is how addictive this game is, how addictive Tottenham are. Just a final word, boys, because this is such a fluid situation. Nagelsmann, as you've mentioned, Dan, or Nagelsmann, whichever way we want to go for it, seems to be Chelsea's number one choice. The Pochettino situation changes from moment to moment. No, he's not been approached by Tottenham. Yes, he's back in favour. Just quickly, with your unique inside information, what do you think is going to happen, certainly in West London, and as things stand, who's favourite to eventually take over in North London?
Well, it looks like Chelsea are moving more quickly than Spurs. I mean, there's reports today from a lot of credible sources that Luis Enrique is flying over from Spain for an interview. As you said, Nagelsmann seems to be well in the frame as well. So as we've kind of touched on, I think it would almost be beneficial for Spurs if Chelsea just make a quick appointment, you know, say either someone's joining imminently or at the end of the season, and then that obstacle is out of the way for Spurs. In terms of what Spurs are doing, it's pretty obvious that you know, Poch is currently more keen on the job than, you know, Spurs are on bringing him back. I think it's fair to say that if he was offered it today, he would probably take it. You know, albeit he will be keeping an eye on the Real Madrid job, as we've said. So, I think Spurs are still in the due diligence phase, that they're taking their time and they're not moving as quickly as Chelsea. This is purely my opinion and not based on the inside info you mentioned very generously there. But if I kind of had a hunch, it would be that Spurs, you know, have already sounded out Nagelsmann and got the impression that he doesn't want to make a decision till the summer, or perhaps that he was holding out for Chelsea, because there was a lot of noise, you know, at the start of the week about, or the back end of last week rather, about Nagelsmann, and that's kind of died down now. And you know, the word from the club is that, you know, he hasn't been approached and that he's, you know, not the top target. My feeling is that he would be a great coach for Spurs and a really good fit, but my feeling is that that's, you know, less likely now than it was, you know, when he was first sacked by Bayern. As for Poch, you know, who knows, but you know, perhaps the club is kind of keeping him on ice, and you know, it's certainly not being ruled out, but you know, that it's not like Spurs are the only club in the world that will want Pochettino. You know, I've mentioned Real Madrid, there'll be other top clubs who will need a manager soon, possibly including Chelsea, you know, who will want to consider him. So I think it's a dangerous game Spurs are playing if they're kind of keeping Poch as the kind of backup or the lever they can pull at the last minute. You know, if they want him and think he would do a good job, then they should go for him now.
I think as well, like, it's interesting, isn't it, the sort of timing of all these things. I mean, I think I said a few weeks ago that my first choice would be Tuchel, and he's, you know, Bayern very swiftly sacked Nagelsmann and got Tuchel in. Now Chelsea, you know, are telling everyone they were backing Potter. As soon as Nagelsmann becomes available, they're suddenly back, they're sacking Potter very quickly as well. I think clubs are seeing Tottenham, you know, on that radar, and people are, you know, the clubs are moving quickly basically to ensure that they don't get beaten to their top targets. You know, I mean, Nagelsmann is a market opportunity for Spurs, but as well for Chelsea, you know, to have a coach like that suddenly available, you can see why clubs are very much keen on bringing him in. The one thing I would say about Nagelsmann is, you know, you go back to the point that, you know, you compare his record to Pochettino's. Ultimately, he did a very impressive job at Leipzig. He did, you know, a decent job at Bayern, probably. But ultimately, you compare that to Pochettino, who also did an extremely good job at Spurs over a longer period of time in the Premier League, at the club that, you know, we're now talking about, went to PSG and did a decent job, probably comparable to what Nagelsmann did at Bayern. Why is Nagelsmann, you know, such a superior choice to Pochettino? Like, in my opinion, it's purely a kind of a, you know, the thing we don't know is, you know, seems more tantalizing than the thing we do. I agree with Dan. Tottenham are playing a dangerous game by sort of, you know, keeping Poch there. And I think they do risk souring some relations here a little bit if they're not careful. You know, if they kind of let this linger, you know, and Pochettino kind of gets the feeling that he is just being sort of kept at the end of the phone, you know, I think there would be Pochettino be well within his rights to jump at a job like Chelsea. And I, you know, the understanding is that he will be on their list as well, that he will talk to them. And I think I've said before that, you know, Real Madrid will be very much interested in the summer. So, you know, Spurs are waiting, but it will come at a price.
Okay. Well, as I said, it's a fluid situation. It could change at any moment. Guys, thank you very much indeed. Dan Kilpatrick of the Evening Standard. Tom Barkley of The Sun, Tom Allnut of The Times. I'm Marcus Buckland, wondering if we might see the lesser spotted Dan Juma at the weekend, and also rejoicing in the one good bit of news that came out of Tottenham this week. Season ticket prices have been frozen for next year, which in the circumstances has to be the correct decision. Thank you for listening. Please do give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. We're on Twitter and Instagram at The Tottenham, where you can follow us on Twitter to enjoy the game this weekend, if you can. We will reflect on that next week, by which time several more managers will probably have been sacked and several more will be in the frame. And who knows, Dan Juma may still be giving interviews after scoring a 5-minute hat-trick after coming off the bench in the 93rd minute against Brighton. We will see. Come on, you Spurs.